Welcome to Great Minds, and our guest today is an old and dear friend. We got to work together a long time ago and had a lot of fun together back at Yahoo many, many years ago. Our guest today is the president and global client leader for Walmart, part of the Publicis Group and the Publicis family of companies, one of my favorites. I love Arthur. I think he's doing a fabulous job leading globally, and Maurice before that. A heartfelt welcome to Alda Abbracciamento. So welcome, Alda.
Thank you, Matt. It's great to be here.
Alda, so many places to start with you, but I want to go all the way back to early days working in fashion and your time with Don Wise, an absolute legend. And I love how that sort of helped shape perspective on advertising and marketing, but from a different place. Mm-hmm. If we can dial the clock back to that pretty small fashion shop, but very influential and clearly influential in shaping you, I thought that might be an unexpected and fun place to begin our conversation today.
Oh my God, Matt. Yes, unexpected, but you know, in thinking about it and thinking about that experience shaped everything. First, I should tell you, I had no idea what advertising was. Don hired me as an account executive because I had jewelry experience, believe it or not. And he had an account called Danecraft at the time. And I met him and he hired me instantly. And I just remember being out on the street at 49th and 3rd Avenue going, I just became an account executive and I have no idea what that is, but wow, that was really exciting. It was really the place I learned everything. I had to teach myself. So he was a very, very famous graphic designer, designed things like the Anne Klein logo, the Paul Stewart logo. It was a world I knew nothing about, having grown up in Queens. That was not my world. And I realized I basically put together a learning agenda on my own and with him and with friends I had in the industry. And it was incredible. I think one of the things that was most incredible is that he introduced me to his friends. So without any sense of competition or fear, he would send me to his friend, Jerry Della Famina. And Jerry Della Famina would make time for me. And I always had a list of questions. And he would be incredibly generous with his time. He would send me to Kevin Mannion, who was leading media at McCann Erickson at the time. And Kevin would make time for me. I took a little class at NYU about how to be an account executive. And That's really how I learned. From a creative perspective, I mean, his friends were Richard Avedon. And, you know, these were the types of people that I was surrounded with and worked with. And I never felt intimidated. I just felt lucky. I just felt lucky and super interested. We grew a lot over that period of time, but most of it was on 7th Avenue, and 7th Avenue was like a real thing. And go from showroom to showroom where designers had a point of view. We were responsible not for creating their point of view, but for translating their point of view or articulating their point of view. So I think that's how I learned to respect, truly respect, a creative mind and strong opinions, but also learned what it meant to really support and help versus, you know, try to be the voice or try to be the lead. And it was a tough business. So anything after that was super easy.
And let's go back to something we talked about before we started recording, which is shared roots in Queens. You know, we both started there. I now live on Long Island. I know you spent part of your growing up years on Long Island, but there's a certain gravitas I find, and I'm definitely biased here. You know, Brooklyn tends to get all the good PR, but there's a certain grit and sort of an almost sense of curiosity I find that comes from folks who have those Queens roots. Do you think I'm onto something there?
Yeah, it's interesting. Certainly the resilience part. I mean, and you have to have real grit. For me, I had this sense of curiosity, but almost to a point of, I knew I didn't want to stay there. And, you know, I grew up in a pretty traditional Italian family, as you can imagine. And they were wonderful and they were so close and they all lived next to each other. And I just remember being literally 8 years old going, I can't stay here. And so it was curiosity and appreciation, but it was more like there's something else out there. And it stayed with me literally forever. But and I don't know why that happened, but it just did.
Yeah, I had that same sort of get up and go. And, last night my daughter said, "Dad, do you think we can go to a Knicks playoff game?" And I said, "Sure." And now I'll have to figure out how to get tickets without having to put a second mortgage on the house to sit somewhere decent. But what that reminded me of was now it's almost 40 years ago. I was 12, and the Knicks were playing the Sixers in the playoffs. And it was Dr. J's last year as a player and Earl Monroe last year as a player for the Knicks. So this goes way back. And I really wanted to go. And I did not have the type of dad who would, say, "Okay, I'll take you." So I had a little bit of money from delivering the Penny Saver. You may remember, may recall the
Remember.
Penny Saver. And I figured out a way as a 12-year-old kid to get myself to Manhattan, and there was no StubHub or,
Yeah.
Ticketmaster, and on your phone, there was no phone. And I figured out how to buy a ticket from a scalper and go to the game. And naturally, because I was not that bright, and that still holds today, I miscalculated and ran out of money and did not have enough money to get home and had to walk about 4 hours to get home. But I saw that game. And I still remember it. And I was not going to be denied one way or the other. And obviously I, eventually found my way home because here we are today. But I think there was that spirit of get up and go that I had also.
And being able to figure anything out, which is true today. It's there's no challenge or hurdle that you feel like you can't like walk through.
Oh, very, that's wonderful. Any chance to talk about Queens, I enjoy. So you move into the big agency world and work at three incredible shops, a particularly noteworthy lengthy tenure at Ogilvy and Mather. Did they say Mather or Mather? I never knew that.
Ogilvy Mather.
Mather, Ogilvy and Mather. David Ogilvy, of course. And but you also worked at Gray, another iconic shop, and the Martin Agency, a favorite of mine. I was very close to the late Mike Hughes, who I held in very, very high regard. And we were very both pleased and sad that his last public appearance before he passed was on our Advertising Week stage in New York many years ago. And I think Ginny, his wife, is still around. But that's a great training ground to work at Gray as a young person. I think we're probably a little similar ages. I might be a touch older, but that was in the late 80s. So talk about that early tenure at Gray, moving from a small shop to a pretty big shop and rising up the ladder to a group management supervisor at a very young age.
Yeah, it interesting. Don and I was there for 6 years, and I'll never forget. I had huge ambition, and we were growing the agency really nicely. And he looked at me and he said, "Elda, we will never be J. Walter Thompson." And that was sort of like that was the moment where I had to move. As painful as it was, I had to move, but it was very, very, very difficult to move from a small agency to a big agency. And everyone said, "You have to have packaged goods experience. You have to have this. You have to have that." And it wasn't easy. But again, it goes back to because I had, in this case, kitchen and bath experience with Formica Corporation, Gray had just won Kohler Plumbing Products. And they couldn't, there was no one else, I guess, in New York City that had that relevant experience. So that is literally how I got to Gray. I had to take a pay cut. I had to take a demotion, but I knew that everyone said you need to do this. And I remember being so shocked at how not hard it was. So I thought I was missing all of these things that a big agency can give you. Only to find out, well, I was actually very well suited to this. And I'm really proud to this day that we did incredibly beautiful work on Kohler. And there was an article in the New York Times, and the client quote was, "We thought we were going to miss a lot by going to a big agency," meaning Gray, "and yet we found a small agency experience in a very large agency." And I think that kind of said it all. But also in those days, it was really easy to be an account person because at Gray, the infrastructure was built for account people to succeed. And that was very different from what I had experienced before because it was built for people like me. And again, to answer your question about rising so quickly, I actually had my son during that period of time. I was actually lucky enough to be promoted right before I went on maternity leave. But then when I came back, I actually started working on the agency's most difficult client, SlimFast. And someone left, and there was an opportunity, and I wanted it. But I was also very patient in terms of them interviewing other people. But eventually, I was able to have that role.
And it sounds like that experience you had in that first half a dozen years, where you have to do kind of a little bit of everything between that and then stepping into a place that had a more built-out infrastructure, that really set you up for success. Fantastic. So you spend 6 years or so, maybe a little more, living in the great city of Richmond. A little bit different than growing up in Queens, a little bit different than Long Island. We used to stay when we went down there for the VCU Brand Center board, which I was on for many years when your old Ogilvy colleague Rick Boyko was running the school. We used to stay at the Jefferson Hotel, and there's no Robert E. Lee Circle in Queens. Talk about that experience. That had to be a little bit of a culture shock. You might have been the only Italian person down there.
Oh, worse than that. I was an Italian married to a Jew. I worked. My husband stayed home and took care of our son. So, yes, we were unlike pretty much anyone else in Richmond, Virginia at that time.
But Martin, an incredible shop, and your tenure there sort of coincided with their emergence from a local success story to a national player.
It was the best of times and worst of times. I'd be lying if I said I ever really felt comfortable in Richmond. I did not. However, they were looking for somebody who had big agency experience. I think they were also looking for a woman at the time. And it was absolute and positive culture shock, both professionally and personally, because you just don't think about the things that people at that time thought about in Richmond. And yes, my office, beautiful office, faced Robert E. Lee. And you're faced with things that you would never, ever, ever think about. And it was also the moment where you felt so, in some ways, responsible, but some ways so vulnerable, because the fact that I was a woman was a real reason I was there, which I have to say, in New York and at Gray, never felt that in a million years. So it was a cultural assault on so many fronts and just, really, really challenging. But I do what I do, which is focus on your clients. So if an agency culture is difficult, if whatever is difficult, focus on your clients. And I was lucky enough to have the most wonderful clients that wanted what I had to provide, but I was also surrounded by the best creative people and the best creative minds, in the industry, even though the agency was still, sort of like on the cusp or verge of becoming a famous agency. I'll never forget, someone said to me, a creative director at the time, he said, "Well, you can come here, but please don't screw it up." So, it was because now I'm a person from a big agency. I'm no longer the person from the small creative agency. So you're like, okay, I get this. I know how to do this. I think what was really exciting is that we had the biggest swings at bat, and we had nothing to lose, not a single thing. And that was freedom. It was, the highs were so high, the lows were so low, but the highs definitely were the dominant experience. It was truly, truly, truly incredible.
So let's stay here for a minute. You talked about the creative department there and the strength creatively. Martin is one of those shops that really for a number of years had that lightning in a bottle. You know, we can go back and we can look. There were a few magical years. I'm still very close with Chuck Porter. And you can go back now and look at Crispin Porter Bogusky. They had a few magical years. So did Martin. Take us inside that creative engine room. What was so extraordinary? Where did that special sauce come from? We touched on Mike Hughes, but there were many, many great leaders there creatively.
Yeah, it was very interesting. Mike and I were very close, but Mike was really smart because he stayed above the fray. As an account person, you actually had huge responsibility to drive the work. And I would like to go to him and say, but Mike, they're not doing this. And he'd be like, and you'd just get sort of sent back. I think that what was magical was that it was a small group of people who knew each other very, very well. And it wasn't all niceties at all. I think everyone had so much passion and it was fine. It was fine to cry in a meeting. It was fine to yell at each other. But then, you know, you'd go home and you'd get a message saying, I'm so sorry. I know I didn't mean to do that. So there was so much passion, but there was so much intimacy at the same time. So it really was, it felt like a group of friends who were trying to do great things and honestly had not a whole lot to lose. I think the writers we had in particular were the best I've ever worked with because they were prolific. If a client had a comment, it wasn't arguing with the client. It was going back and how can I do better? And there was so much of that. It's like, what about this? What about this? What about this? I think that's really where it was a culture of it is up to us. It is not up to our clients to, you know, make bad work or not do the work that we really need to do. And I think you also had, it's also where I learned that you can't protect creative. You have to put them at the table, as painful as it might be. And we had some very interesting, painful times, but they wanted to overcome. I mean, it was just a feeling of we're going to win. We're going to win no matter what. And we're going to win because we're good. Good at what we do, but also good people at the same time.
Yeah, that was my take, was that there was a humanity to, and I think it started with Mike and then filtered down, that was very unique to the Martin culture.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, he was so self-effacing. You know, he'd come into a room with his huge, big Diet Coke. He would spill it half the time. But it was also, and I don't mean this to be judgmental anyway, it was very calculated. Like, they were really smart. John and Mike were really smart. Nothing happened by accident. Nothing happened by accident.
Referring to the great John Adams.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. Mike had one of the great, great jokes when they dedicated the VCU Brand Center building as Mike Hughes Hall. Mike came down. Mike was there, of course, and all the IPG folks. They were the only holding company, Michael Roth, to their credit, that contributed real money to build the Brand Center. All the others turned it down. And despite the fact that the Brand Center produces talent for all of them and about 40% people of color, the building is literally called Mike Hughes Hall. And yeah. Mike in his remarks recognized his friend Larry Hall, who was there, who thinks the building is also named after him. And I thought he delivered in his Mike Hughes way. Yeah. And it was so funny. But what a special guy. You end up, as they grow, you open an office for them out west.
I would say things, Mike and I would go out to lunch probably once a week. And, you know, he knew that Richmond was not my favorite place. And I'm going, I got to get out of here. And he's like, you're fine. And then one day he says, okay, you want to go to San Francisco? Now, this was after we already had an LA office that did not succeed. I'm like, San Francisco. And he was very specific about why we needed to go to San Francisco. We needed to go to San Francisco because we had to build our TV reel, believe it or not. And we needed talent. It was the last thing in the world I thought about doing. And I remember My son was, I think, 10 at the time. And I asked him, I asked my husband, and my son said, you know, because now we're going to move, we're going to uproot our family, we're going to do all of these things. And my son says, Mom, it's just tomatoes and the salad of life. If we don't like it, we'll come back. And that's pretty much what Mike said. If you don't like it, you'll come, you know, you can come back. But it was, what a spectacular opportunity at exactly the wrong time. So we had a lot of dot-com business. We had won a bunch of Charles Schwab business. This literally happened on my way from Richmond to San Francisco. I think most of the dot-coms imploded, and I spent the first 6 months just collecting fees and debts for all the dot-coms that went out of business. Yeah, it was a crazy time, but we did attract really, really amazing talent, and we were small and mighty for a good amount of time.
Let's talk about a related subject. You talked about, you know, when you first gave birth and your husband stayed home while you were working. Talk about that work-life balance, because I know you well enough to know that not only are you a dynamic leader and accomplished person from a business vantage point, but you're also a great mom. Talk about how you navigated that, especially during those earlier years where, you know, between the mom and the dad, you know, if we're going to say who's more important in the house, if we're going to be really blunt and crass, it's the mom, certainly in my house.
Well, it's literally an ongoing recurring joke where we try to get my son to choose one of us over another. But honestly, that's why I moved to Richmond. I thought it would be a lot easier, you know, not commuting, thought, you know, Richmond would be a lot slower. And that's why we went, only to find out that any client meeting required you to get on a plane and go somewhere else. And also the ambition of the Martin Agency, you know, required you to be full on. I mean, I don't think I would have been able comfortably to do what I did without my husband's support. I don't think that would have been possible, because as my husband would say, you are so there, you are so present, you were so present that he doesn't even notice when you're gone. Every day you balance something. Some days work great, some days are terrible. And I never looked at it as like, this is for the rest of my life. I just needed to get through today. You make those choices and, you know, you get through it.
Well, that's the ultimate compliment. So present, they don't notice when you're gone. You can't have higher praise. So I'm going to guess that somewhere along the time of your tenure out in San Francisco with Martin, somebody at WPP took notice of you. And you moved to Ogilvy, beginning a long tenure. I think that's where we met when Ogilvy was doing a lot of work in the halcyon days of Yahoo.
Yeah.
I'd love to talk about your journey to the WPP family in Ogilvy and get into that a little bit. Another great shop. And you had an incredible 15-year run there. I mean, that's unheard of today.
Yes. You know, I did not get to Ogilvy through a traditional door. And it very much fed both desires to stay quite entrepreneurial, but also to stay in technology, to not leave Silicon Valley, which I loved. And the opportunity presented itself, which was very specific, because I actually came through like a small agency door that was part of Ogilvy, but not sitting within Ogilvy, called Soho Square at the time. And it actually required me to be in San Francisco probably half the time. So I thought that was amazing. I really had, after Martin Agency, I had no desire to work for another agency except Ogilvy. There was no other agency I would have gone to. And the reason for that is eventually I wanted to be able to really lead and understand global business, which, you know, I had pieces of, but certainly nothing like an Ogilvy global network. And it was the only place, that was the only place I really wanted to be. So it was an interesting way in. It was small, it was entrepreneurial. That Yahoo assignment started out as a very tiny Rand assignment and grew to something quite substantial and global, you know, over the course of the next 4 years. And talk about glory days. It was also being able to watch, you know, such a major player grow and then, you know, subsequently become less than that. But yeah, it was a fascinating entry into Ogilvy.
All right, so we're going to dig in a little bit more about Yahoo, but you talked about, you know, literally, you know, brands disappearing and spending your first 6 months in San Francisco effectively collecting debt and being touched by bankruptcies, et cetera. Some of the brands made it, many did not. Yahoo, it's been through a lot of iterations, but it's still standing. But so many are gone. What were the attributes that you saw with the benefit of hindsight of those that made it versus those that didn't?
I think those that made it had a true value proposition, something real and something important. That's probably number one. I think number two is they had a humbleness about them, because some of the ones that went under, they were so incredibly arrogant and had very little understanding of business and the way business works. And there were also those that failed that did not value their agency relationships, you know, where you just became, you know, we have a pile of money, so you should take it and you should do something with it. Well, that's not how it works. We're a business. We think about business. We don't just collect piles of money and do whatever you tell us to do. So that was, I think, really having a value proposition and a humbleness were things that, you know, for the most part, we're missing from a lot of these dot-coms. I think those were important characteristics.
Who made it that surprised you, and who disappeared on the other hand that you said, you know what, they kind of had it coming to them?
Many became iterations. It was just too early. You know, thinking about, was it BabyCenter at the time? And my good friend Mark Selko, who was actually my client at Amgen, started that. That was one of the very first forays into e-commerce and content. It was just very early, you know. So I but again, you know, that idea, you know, has lived on and over time has really taken a hold. But I think when these companies also sold their companies to other larger companies, and we see that all the time. We see that with some of Yahoo's acquisitions, for example. When you're buying a startup, you're buying something very specific and it needs very specific things. And I think big companies sort of buying these enterprises, they end up investing in other things that may not actually be the essence of what that startup actually brings.
Yeah, Yahoo was such an odd juxtaposition because you were one of many, many talented people who I got a chance to work for and with. And as a farm system of talent, you could argue that Yahoo is the heavyweight champion, that there are more people today still working in the business in very high levels across a broad continuum who at some point were there. The flip side of that coin is no one was better, and we'll put better squarely in quotes here, at buying companies and wrecking them than Yahoo was.
Yes.
And that's an odd juxtaposition.
Yeah. Yeah. And to watch it happening, I remember sitting there, and Yahoo was so incredible because there were so many talented people there. But as an agency partner, for example, you felt you were a part of that company. To have that level of transparency, to have that level of intimacy is like, you know, as an agency person, that's as good as it gets. The flip side to that is you see all the things you wish either weren't happening or you don't want to see, but you're in it. You have no choice. I don't know if it was hubris. I don't know if it was arrogance. I don't know what it was, but there was that moment in time where bad decision after bad decision after bad decision is being made. And everyone knows it's a bad decision, but it's still being made. And actually, I see that happening all the time. But I would say, from my perspective, we as an agency and as an agency team still tried to do the right thing, still tried hard to fight for things that we knew could be better, could be right. And then to be able to have the audience, that was also pretty incredible. So you kind of all won together, you kind of all failed together.
Yeah, it was a front row seat that I think
Yes.
neither of us would give up. So you then get a dream that not a lot of people get, which combines all aspects of your life. And you join your son's outfit, Flight mm-hmm. Desk, in Boulder, another great, great part of the country. You've lived in some fabulous places.
Yeah.
None as fabulous as Ozone Park and Howard Beach and Queens, of course. But can we talk about Flight Desk as a startup, aggregating a lot of college media, focusing on that audience, early to that game also. But that had to be a unique thrill to work with your son.
Yes. Yes, in many ways. Well, it was interesting because the way he developed the business based on all of his broad advertising experience with his mom was he was editor-in-chief of his college newspaper, and it was really hard to get ad revenue to pay his writers. And he's like, but mom, this is the most valuable audience. Like, why would people not want to pay to reach college kids? That's how he started Flight Desk, because actually it's really hard to reach college kids. So timing is everything. Became a board member, an advisor, but then he would challenge me and he'd say, okay, when are you going to do, actually, I think he said, when are you going to do something important? When are you going to do something that really matters? And it was a great time to do that. It was unfortunately during COVID and right before the 2020 election. But I did spend 2 years working with him, working in a startup environment, and honestly having to unlearn a lot of things that I just took for granted. I mean, it was very hard, and probably the most difficult recognition or lesson was he would say to me, you have a lot of great ideas, but if you don't know how to make one of them, it doesn't matter. And, you know, I think you rise through the agency ranks at Ogilvy. You have lots of people. You basically have to be a thinker and a leader, but you don't have to make things. You don't have to do things. And all of a sudden you find yourself having to like actually put a deck together, which I thought was a great lesson to learn coming back into big business, because I don't take for granted what it takes to actually do that. Because I think you get to a point and you just don't think about it. You're like, of course you can do that. It couldn't take more than 5 minutes. Guess what? It takes about 50 hours. I think with a startup in particular, well, first of all, watching your son as a leader is one hand terrifying and the other hand literally awe-inspiring. You're like, how on earth? And it was very clear, always very clear who was in charge. There was never, I don't think, any confusion ever on who I was serving, for sure. But that's really where you get into what's more important, experience or passion. And at that moment in time, I would say that my son and many people at the company really thought passion was more important than experience. I would be lying if I said I didn't get frustrated, because I think as an experienced leader, being in business for as long as I have, you're able to look at not just what's happening today, but what's going to happen in 6 months, what's going to happen in a year, what's going to happen, you know, in 3 years. And you can plan concurrently for all of those things. When you're a startup with very limited resources, whether that's time or money, you're focused on the here and now. And that was the moment of tension for us. And then finally, what was very exciting was to be in a selling position. When you're an account person, you're advising, you're a consultant, I never thought of myself as selling anything. And now I'm actually selling things, which again is also, that's scary and humbling and all of those things, but also so much fun. You know, for the 2020 election, we needed a lot more ad inventory because obviously campaigns and parties are spending a lot of money. And so it actually, I very much went back to my Yahoo roots, because we didn't create a digital inventory primarily. We created ad units. I sold ad units. It was phenomenal. I had this like incredible board. I'm like, this is amazing. And it added so much value to the business, but not in a way that I would have expected I would add value.
And it sounds like some of that early groundwork that you did with Don Weiss all came back also, where you have to do a little bit of everything.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And I think in my heart, really being an entrepreneur, even in big companies, working with big brands, there's still very much an element of you need to create on the fly, and not all the answers are there.
Just a great, great story. Somewhere along the line, somebody else comes knocking, and it's Publicis with a big, big gig. I think at that point, it was the Power of One agency for Walmart. But yeah. I'd love to hear that story, and then let's bring us up to present day and what you've got cooking in the kitchen right now with the great, great company that is Walmart.
Yes, it was definitely a knock on the door that I never expected in a million years. Never expected to go back to a holding company in a role like this. But it was interesting because this was during COVID, and Walmart in particular, and brands like Walmart, like the world was upside down and inside out. I had no idea how long I'd be sitting in this apartment for. All of a sudden, Walmart became a really important part of people's lives. I don't think I was ever so happy to be able to go to a Walmart on Long Island and buy my paper towels and toilet paper. I think from a retail and an e-commerce perspective, you know, Amazon wasn't the only game in town anymore, you know? So it really opened my eyes to that company and brand in particular, and really changed, I think, how I thought about it and how important it really was. Because it was very important to, you know, to our lives. I have never worked in retail before, and that was terrifying and also interesting. But what sold me was Artur's commitment to a Power of One model. So whether I was at WPP and working on global businesses like UPS or BP, I mean, the reality is you were still very much encased in an agency. This model is completely different and also completely feeds my entrepreneurial need, because you get, as a global client leader, to create the right set of agencies and talent and expertise for whatever your client needs. And I know this sounds like a Publicis commercial, and I don't mean it to be, but the investments that Publicis made in Epsilon and in Sapient were the things that our clients actually needed. Not that creative wasn't important, because creative is hugely important. But in order to really help clients transform, you need all of these things. And that makes your job much, not only easier, but more successful. And so it was the model that we had always promised as an account leader, but here it's real. And to be able to experience that at this point in my career, it's almost like, wow, after all this time, someone has actually figured it out. And the fact that as a client, Walmart had huge respect for the model, it just works and allows you to get involved in so many things that you typically would not be involved with, and really to look holistically at a business, especially a business as big and as complicated as Walmart.
Amazing story. You're give or take 3 years in.
Yeah.
How's it going?
My God, I'm addicted. I love it. You know, I will say the first couple of months were really hard. It's very different culture. You know, I grew up in the brand world, like brand was everything. In retail, you have the here and now. It was very different. It's also hard coming in as a very senior person to a new holding company, but the culture for me has been very much about what can we do to help you? What can we do to help you without really any arrogance around that? If you win, everybody wins is very much the mentality. The work we've done for Walmart has, you know, just increasingly become better, more impactful, where we think about culture in a very different way. We think about inclusivity in a very different way. It feels to me like the pinnacle of the things that the industry has really been struggling with for a very long time. And it's such a gift to be able to have all of that come full circle with a real set of experience and expertise that delivers on the best of what we always wanted to deliver for clients.
I love that story and the way you put it. As we've sort of created a narrative of your whole career, you've really ended up at what seems to be sort of a perfect spot for you that combines so many of your skill sets, the cultural difference in the experience that you've had living in Virginia. I'm guessing you're spending a bunch of time in Arkansas. It's got to all help you in some fashion.
Yeah.
As we wrap, I'd love to ask you a question that may be hard to answer. You've done so much. You're still young. You still got more years ahead of you. Is there something else out there that you sort of in the back of your mind want to get to?
Not to follow on Kristen Cavallo's footsteps, but I have so much interest and passion and just absolute utter disappointment in terms of where we are, particularly with women's reproductive rights. And it is a shocking, shocking, shocking notion that we are here. One thing that I did not tell you is my last year in college, I was a lobbyist for the National Abortion Rights Action League as part of an independent study project. I need to figure out how to go back and how to help. And that's what's really in the back of my mind. I will do something.
It's absolutely surreal in so many ways how we're going back. I think the laws that were just passed in Arizona, I'm 99% sure I read, took us back to Civil War era.
It did. 1864, I believe. Yep.
Yeah, it's so frightening. Well, yeah. This was not to end on that note, but a serious note and an important one. And you are not only an advocate and have been for that issue, and sounds like that's going to be part of your future, but really manifest leadership. Men, women, you're doing it. And you happen to be a dynamic female leader, but you are first and foremost a leader. And you lead with humanity, and the culture you've created at Publicis Now mirrors you. And that's what everybody who touches your shop says, and I think they're right. And I'm so glad we got to have this little reunion, and we did get to talk about Mike Hughes, Queens. That's two enormous wins. I loved our conversation and can't thank you enough for doing it.
Thanks, Matt. Me too.